All right, good morning, Cove Church. Here we go, continuing in on our series here, Relationship Goals. That's why I'm up here, to tell you all about all I know about relationships. John kicked off last week talking about singleness, and of course we're moving right into romantic relationships, mainly outside of marriage, although romance can still exist in marriage. Can I get an amen out there? Contrary to maybe some popular belief, right? This morning we're going to focus on those relationships that exist outside of marriage and what may be called the dating world, if that's even a thing anymore. And so I thought I'd just start off with a quick question. This is just kind of going back to my own background in dating, which, you know, was not a lot, honestly, just to be honest with you. But my wife and I were fortunate enough to be set up by friends. Now, how many of you guys out there are married to someone who you got set up with? Anybody else besides a few? Wow, okay, not as many as I expected. And that's kind of interesting, but it is kind of what you might expect in some ways, because what we found is that in our dating habits, we become more and more removed from the influences of family and even friends. And so, whereas a lot of people might get set up, like myself and my wife, we were in Indianapolis, and I had lived there for about 2 years, and she went to college up there, moved back into the city, and her roommate and my roommate were friends, and it's kind of a funny story. My roommate had invited a girl over to watch a movie, and they were going to watch this movie together, and she happened to ask me, "Al, would you come? Do you want to come and watch the movie with us?" And I was like, "Well, what movie is it?" It's a good question to ask. And so the movie, you know, it wasn't like it was just a terrible movie, but it was one that, you know, I really didn't think I needed to be watching, especially in its company. And so she said, "Oh, are you like religious or something?" And I thought, that's an interesting question. Yeah, I guess you would probably kind of say that, although I like to think of it more as just, you know, not religion or religious in a sense, but I try to honor God, you know, with my life, and we could talk about that more if you like. She's like, "Well, no, I just asked because my roommate, she's kind of like that, weird, right?" So you guys, y'all should totally get together, all right? And a couple months later, it took a while to get us together. We end up at this party. They, you know, kind of orchestrate us to be at this party. And so we start talking and you know, in a group, and we're having a good conversation, and everything, I think, is going pretty well. And so then we go to leave, and so I'm going to walk her to her door. She actually lives in an apartment right, like, above where we were at, you know, just kind of hanging out, as it were. And so I walked her to the door, and I said, "Hey, listen, I've enjoyed meeting you. I know our friends are trying to get us together. You know, would you mind if I had your number and called you sometime, and we went out?" And she looked at me, and she said, "Well, I don't have a pen or paper with me, and I don't really feel comfortable inviting you up to my, you know, apartment. I just met you, so you can just get to me through one of your friends, you know, because they obviously, you know, have my contact information." And so I looked at her, and I said, "It's nice to meet you, Dawn. Thank you." And kind of turned and walked off, feeling pretty dejected, because I took that as a soft no, right? Like, it's like, it's that kind of, you know, it's not you, it's me kind of no, in that situation. But as it were, she really just didn't have a pen and paper, and we weren't into the whole, you know, we had cell phones, but they were kind of new. I don't know why she didn't just give me your number and a cell phone, but it was very new. This is early, like, 2000s, but long story short, we end up getting together, dating, and are married, and are still married now, 15 years later, so thank God for that. That is a true testament to grace, absolutely. I can tell you that on her part, for sure. But what I want to kind of focus on this morning is for us to kind of look and see if we can get some biblical wisdom in this area of dating, romantic relationships. And I say wisdom because, just to be honest with you up front, the Bible doesn't directly address dating. There's no verse, chapter, verse, "Thou shalt date this way," or because it just wasn't a thing. I mean, dating is a relatively newcomer in terms of our cultural practices. In fact, for most times and most places, and still to really today even geographically, there's so much more. What happens is this idea of an arranged marriage. That's the way things have happened most times, most places, even still prevalent today. In fact, there was an article that came out in 2013 that was surveying some data looking at happiness factors in marriages in India, which are still a very large percentage of arranged marriages, and those in the United States who marry for romance, you know, love. And what they found was that on a whole, as time progressed, arranged marriages actually became more set. Like their satisfaction quotient, which they used in both surveys, actually went up, while sometimes, or in other trends in America for romance, the satisfaction actually waned as time went on. And it's interesting because one of the things that they found, the researchers, they concluded that this idea of commitment and sacrifice that starts out at the very beginning of any type of arranged marriage, that it's that as that grows over time, it actually becomes sweeter. But if those two things aren't at the foundation, if they're not at the bedrock, you know, if all it is just two kind of starry-eyed lovers coming together and thinking they're going to make a life, that can be a really rocky road. And so for years, most people in most cultures have said it's too big of a decision, it's too important to leave this to just two people isolated, alone. And so arranged marriages was kind of the thing in biblical times, and that was the course for most of his, but still your choices of marriage and who you were going to marry was very limited. It wasn't until about the 19th century, there was this phenomenon called courting that came. You would court or call on someone, and oftentimes this was initiated, it was okayed by the girl. The girl would say, "It's okay if you come and call on me," right? And so then that would cue the guy that he needed to take initiative, and he would come and meet with the parents, and they would go off to the front porch, you know, most of the times, or some other public area, and they would sit there and they would talk, right? They would get to know each other. They might do something together as families. And basically, this was a time when the families were checking this guy out, this caller, to see if he was going to be a good suit for their daughter. And that's kind of how things rolled until the 20th century. Really, dating as a term shows up not till about 1914, so about the last 100 years. And it started off in kind of the working poor who didn't have parlors in their homes and didn't have other places they could kind of go publicly in that way. And so what they would do is they would come and they would take people out and they would go out on these dates out on the town. And as entertainment culture happened, think about automobiles and movies, this whole phenomenon became more and more detached from the idea of family, friends, community, and became much more autonomous for fun, and you know, almost dating as recreational purposes for a long time, to find this fit, to find this person who eventually you may go and tie the knot with. Today, I think we've actually moved past dating in a lot of ways. It's a bit antiquated. It's still in our collective psyche, and people still use that terminology, but it doesn't often mean the same things as it's meant before. It's oftentimes things, words can kind of change, concepts can kind of change. So much so, in fact, that a Dr. Carrie Cronin, who is a professor of ethics and philosophy at Boston College, she realized about 10 years ago that her students did not know how to date. Whether that was that they were so caught up in college life or what is sometimes known as the hookup culture, we may look back at that here again in a minute, but they were so caught up in the things that they didn't know how to date. And so she created this class. It was a senior seminar class, literally, that students would take, and she became famous for this, right, especially on campus, and even they made a documentary out of it called The Dating Project, which is really cool if you want to check that out, The Dating Project. And she would literally instruct their students how they, and someone had, like you had to pass the class. To pass the class, you had to do these things. You had to go through this process. And the process looked like this. You have to physically approach someone face to face and ask them to do some activity with you. Not over text, not through Christian Tingle, not online, but you had to actually face-to-face, and this had to be someone that you were interested in romantically, and you had to have pre-thought, like you had to have forethought in what you were going to do, so that you weren't just like, okay, sweet, I'll pick you up at 7, and we'll go hang out or whatever. I mean, you actually had to have something new. And the first date can only be 90 minutes. 90 minutes. This is your surveying time, you know, where you're surveying the scene and you're trying to really get to know someone, and you had to be in a public place. So yeah, but she literally had a first level dating, then second level, and she had this whole thing. It's really kind of interesting. Because she just found out that people didn't know how to date anymore. And so what I thought I would do is go through and look and try to kind of call out some things that I think are just bad ideas when it comes to what dating might look like, all right? So these are just kind of, this is using biblical wisdom and other, you know, research. I've been doing a lot of that lately, and it's kind of disheartening in some ways, but also it's kind of interesting. So we're going to look at some ways, as I think, of not to date. The first one that we're going to go to is this. It's dating with the God card. This is especially for Christians, you know. We as followers of Jesus, we don't need to be wagging our finger at the world, at those outside the church, and you know, telling them how they should handle relationships. But for us, as followers of Christ, you know, I think we need to really take stock and be accountable, because while people outside the world may date because of loneliness, sexual desire, pride, oftentimes, you know, what we do is we should be about honoring God, right? We should date in a way that honors God and that cares and serves and loves others, following the great two commandments, to love God and love people. But there is a way that we can maybe take this too far, this idea too far. And what I mean by that is this, is that you can take things so seriously that it's kind of like this burning bush approach where, you know, you pray, and then you come up to someone and you say, I believe God has told me that I should ask you out. So I'll pick you up Friday at 8, right? And she's like, no, God did not tell me that, right? Like, I'm not hearing that. There's not that same connection here. Or on the reverse side, the girl does say, oh, wow, okay, God told you that. Must be serious. I should go out with you. And then that works for about a month, but then you come back and say, I was doing my quiet time in James this morning, and I just feel like God told me to break up with you. She's like, I was reading James last week. I didn't see that in there. I don't understand, right? And so I'm just going to, for you guys, the students that are in here, you know, please, I remember when I was a student pastor not too long ago over here, I would just tell you, don't use the God card. I mean, if you're going to break up with a girl, don't blame that on God, right? Maybe God has told you, you know, or especially if you're the girl, you need to break up with this jerk, right? And that's totally cool, but let them know why you're doing it. Because, you know, God told me you're a jerk. I mean, that's one thing. But let them know the reason why it is, and just be honest with yourself and be upfront. Don't hide behind the God card. So that's one thing. The next one is dating as shopping. Dating as shopping. Last week, John talked about this idea of the proverbial one, right? Like unicorns, they exist in our minds, but not in reality. And so the one, if you're shopping, if you have this list and all, you know, like they have to meet X, Y, Z requirements, a lot of times they're physical requirements. I'm not saying you don't have standards. Standards are very important. Hear me say, keep your standards, keep them high. But if you approach dating as kind of this shopping list that you're going to go down looking for the proverbial Mr. Right or Mrs. Right, you're not going to find them. For one thing, you're focused more on the other person, whereas in our dating relationships, like anything else, we need to be asking not, is this, who is the best person, the Mr. Right or Mrs. Right for me, but how can I become a Mr. Right or a Mrs. Right for someone else? Because Tim Keller says this in his book, Every Good Endeavor. He says, everybody is a little bit wrong for you. Right? Because we're all sinners. We've all fallen short of the glory of God. And so so the idea is to find somebody that's less wrong than someone else as best you can. And that's not romantic, but it's just kind of real life. And one of the things I've noticed that I think is just interesting, it doesn't get talked about much, but in terms of this idea of shopping and our standards and what we think about and how we go about approaching dating, oftentimes it can be so much on the surface level. But if you think about it, you know, 60, 80 years ago, which isn't like a long time ago, I mean, my grandfather was growing up in Tennessee, in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and he went to school, right, in a schoolhouse, probably with every other grade was in that schoolhouse. And over the course of his life, up until he proposed to my grandmother, and they were both like 17, 18 years old, right, crazy young, we're actually up to about 29 for guys and 27 for girls in terms of the average age that people get married today. Just 15 years ago when I got married, the average was 25 and 23. So it's escalating rapidly. In fact, that's exactly what Don and I were, 25 and 23. We're right on average. But here, many years ago, my grandfather would have grown up, and he would have surveyed the scene, you know, in his small sphere of girls that he would have seen. And it's not just that he would have surveyed a smaller, like, sample size or smaller, you know, shopping list, per se, but also he wouldn't have seen that many, maybe 200 images of girls in his whole life up until that point. Think about it. The photography, you know, wasn't, up until about the turn of the century, it just wasn't a thing. People didn't carry photos. They sure didn't have like 1,000 of them on their iPhones. It wasn't about the 1920s where you actually had photographs and colors showing up in magazines where people could take and market a certain look to someone else. And so for years, you know, you would only see a few faces, much less, and they were actually real people, not in magazines, not Photoshop and everything else. Fast forward to today, how many thousands of images do we see? If you have a student, how many thousands of images are they going to see by the time they hit 18, 20, much less up until they're 28, if they're on average getting married now? What do you think that might do to our perception of beauty? What do you think that might do to our ideas of comparing other people, especially on the surface level, and thinking, hot or not? And that's actually an app, right? We're just going, you're just rating people. It's terrible. I mean, you got to laugh at it to keep from crying. But that's kind of the world we live in. So dating is shopping. The one is not out there. Try to be the one. That's more important. Number three. And this one I really like to harp on. This is the dating as hanging out. Dating as hanging out. So you see a couple in Starbucks, right? And the next day, you see your friend say, hey, I saw you hanging out with so-and-so the other day at Starbucks. So are y'all dating now? Nah, bro, we just hanging out. you doing homework or something? Or, you know, like, nah, I was hanging out. How often do you hang out with her? About every day. Right? Because this oftentimes leads to the next dating faux pas, I think, which is dating as the disappearance, the disappearing act, you know? This is one of those situations where, you know, you're talking to a friend, you're like, oh, did you hear about Mike over here? No, what happened? Mike's gone again, you know? Why? Well, he started hanging out with, you know, Mary, and all of a sudden, you don't see Mike or Mary for like 6 months later, so they resurface all of a sudden, you know, one a little bit more heartbroken than the other. And in this, and again, this is this idea where people can just become so consumed. They jump in so fast into a relationship, and it's not even one that's defined, really. It's just this hanging out kind of phenomenon, and that sucks all of your time and sucks you away from community, from friends, from family, from people that can actually speak into your life. And that can end real tragic. So the point here is, be upfront with the person that you're hanging out with. You know, define your terms. Tell them what your intentions are. Make that plain. Communicate your levels of commitment to them. Be open. Be honest and share. Very, very important. The next one here, and this is dating is playing house. Dating is playing house. This kind of leads right in from the hanging out to the disappearance, and then finally moves into the cohabitation mode, where more and more people now are cohabitating before marriage. Kind of like, you know, you have a test drive of a car, and you go take it around the blocks for a few times before you buy it. That's the general idea with marriage. Or maybe it's an audition, right? We're going to, you know, you get an audition before we figure out if you get the part in the play. That's the kind of things I like in this too. Another author who wrote this book called Divine Sex, which is an amazing book in relationships, he says this, if intimate relationships were mortgages, we might call these cohabitation relationships, as subprime commitments. They are high-risk projects with little or no collateral security. Unfortunately, just like the subprime mortgages, these relationships are destined to fail. And that's not like, that is the Bible saying that in a lot of ways, that you have more likelihood. But also, that's just statistical, that's sociological science. It turns out that about 1 in 5 cohabitating couples end up in a marriage relationship. And then if you've cohabitated, you're at least twice as likely to be divorced as someone who has waited and saved that experience for marriage. Also, people who practice serial monogamy, which is this way of going from one serious dating, intimate relationship to another, as they go before they finally get to marriage, then that person is much more likely to experience either unfaithfulness in marriage or divorce. And if you think about it, it just makes sense, because everything that we do in our lives is formation. You know, we're forming ourselves. We're creating habits of thought and mind. And so if you continue to dive in deep and quickly into intimate relationships with other people, just to break them off again, what you do is you get good at getting into intimate relationships with people and breaking it off again. This is what you're good at. And so this idea of being able to work through problems and be committed and sacrifice, those two big things that really are at the core and foundation of what it takes to make a relationship survive, sacrifice and commitment, you're not cultivating that in your own heart, in your dating practices, if you're not practicing restraint, putting the other person before yourself, thinking about the person you're becoming in this. And so these things, I think, in terms of wisdom, are just not wise approaches to go with. So we're going to look at some biblical passages here in a second to help us with this, but I have one more big kind of question that I think is on everybody's mind, especially the unmarried's mind, especially if you're a student. This is one I would get all the time. And it would be this question here, simply, well, how far is too far? I mean, you know, Alan, how far is too far with the girl I'm hanging out with? That was basically the question, right? And what I want us to think about, what I want us to kind of move into now, is this idea for us to get a different picture, a different story, a different vision for this question, because I think this is the wrong question. It's not, the question shouldn't be how far is too far. The question should be, as I mentioned, is what kind of person am I becoming in this relationship? And what is this relationship doing to the people who I care about the most and who love me the most? That those two questions are much more interesting. It's how can I honor God? How can I become the kind of person that can be faithful and they can enter into relationships that are healthy and that last? And so I want us to just have a picture of this. This is a way about answering this question, because as you guys know, that one of the Facebook questions that was up that John and Ryan had to tackle this week was, is sex outside of marriage wrong? And the Christian answer is yes. You know, C.S. Lewis once said this is the most unpopular of Christian, you know, virtues, but it is one nonetheless. He likened sex outside of marriage as tasting your food, but then spitting it out, refusing to swallow it. It's an interesting analogy. But we're going to look at this picture. And so instead of just kind of giving you a hard yes, sir, I mean, clearly through the Bible, sexual intimacy is meant for marriage. But I want to try to paint a picture and show you kind of an idea and a vision for why that's good. That's not a repressive thing. Because in our world now, you know, for most times in culture, this Christian idea, while thought hard, was still seen as being virtuous, was still seen as being something that was good, at least to shoot for, even if it was difficult. Now, this idea is more repressive and seen as being repressive. We need, as the church, again, we're not trying to condemn and tell people outside the world how they should do their dating relationships, but we need to be, as a church, being able to offer them an alternative vision of what good, healthy, joyous relationships look like. And part of that, I think, starts here. So let's look at this picture. This is called a hoopa. You guys say that. Hoopa is just a fun word to say. Make sure you guys are still tracking with me out there. So say hoopa on three. One, two, three. Hoopa! I like it. Nice. So I think we have a picture of that here. Yes. Awesome. So as you can see, this is something still used today in many traditional Jewish weddings. And there at the top, what's used as a canopy, was typically a prayer shawl. All right, you can go back to the book of Numbers and read about how they would kind of put this together. But essentially, what they saw this prayer shawl as was the glory or the presence of God over the couple. And it harkens all the way back to the Exodus when God was leading his people out, and he was like a pillar of fire at night and smoke, you know, by day, and they were going through the wilderness, but God's presence was there, was hovering over them. And so they would have these prayer shawls, and they would go through and tie knots and have different prayers. And then when it came to the wedding time, they would take these posts, put the prayer shawl up as a canopy, and they would either, you know, have different holding places, or they would have friends that would hold them. And then they would come, the married couple would come, and they would do their vows underneath the hoopa. As you can see, it's open on all four sides, which is an indication that family and friends and community are to come and to be a part of this relationship under God. And in biblical times, what they would do, so the time when Jesus would be teaching, imagine what they would do is they would come and they would have their ceremony under the hoopah, and then the friends would take this wedding procession and the bride and the groom who had just been married, and they'd take them back and they would follow them along under the hoopah, the whole wedding party out, and they would go to the honeymoon chambers, and they would take the hoopah and they'd tie it, you know, put it up over the bed. The wedding party would wait outside. Off we fly them. And the couple would consummate the marriage under the hoopah. After that happened, they'd walk out the door, and boom, party time. It's ready, yo. Ready to party. The wedding party celebration has begun. These two now have become ikad, Hebrew word ikad, or one flesh. The same word that's used of God describing his unity in diversity, his singleness of purpose in mind. That these two people have become one, and now it's time to party. And you hear that, and if you're like me, you think, that's weird, right? Like, can you imagine coming outside, hey, high five, and yeah, let's go, right? And we think that's just kind of weird, right? Could you imagine that? Oh, my gosh. But as I was thinking about this, it just occurred to me, who is really weird in this situation? You know, the Jewish culture at this time, they weren't all hung up about sex and sexuality. They didn't have these, you know, this hang up. It was bad. It was dirty. It was, you know, this reaction against sexuality. It was right there to be celebrated in the community. They just kept it under the hoopah. Now, what do we do in our culture? We think that's out there. We think that's kind of weird. But, you know, what we do is we take sex out from under the hoopah. We film it. We put it in magazines. We market it. We use it to sell everything from razors to race cars. We mechanize it, right? Going through the checkout line, four ways to make them go, woo, five ways, you can get the idea. We mechanize and make it this performance, this audition, this, 12 steps to that, or whatever else it is. It's everywhere in our culture, but yet that seems weird, right? I mean, when sex gets out from under the hoopah, it turns into something different than what it was originally intended for, which its intention was to bring these two people to make them one, and to give them a way to express themselves and to have an intimacy with them, to say something that was only meant for them and no one else, to help them through the times in marriage that are tough. You know, here's the thing. The more and the faster you get intimate with another person, the more blind you become. Now, this is why sometimes you may have this conversation. Can you believe that John is still with Mary? I mean, gosh, you know, what is she seeing him? He's saying, or vice versa. And it's because oftentimes that intimacy, it blinds us. Now, a little bit of blindness in marriage is good. All right? You need that in marriage, okay? Like a little just healthy blindness in terms of being with that person, because again, they ain't the one, right? You'll find that out soon enough. But if you're in that marriage relationship, it's meant to bring us together and to make love a little blind in that sense, to keep that and to keep us together in a way of experiencing something that we don't experience with anyone else. And so when sex is taken outside of the huppah and put in reverse, oftentimes that's where we are at in a culture now, the hookup culture that I mentioned earlier, it oftentimes begins there. It begins with sex or some type of a hookup or intimacy. And then only after that, well, maybe if we have chemistry, we'll be friends. And maybe after that, you know, we'll see where this relationship goes. And it's completely put the cart before the horse and turned it upside down to where now marriage isn't this destination that we're getting to, that we're practicing discipline in, that we're, you know, saving ourselves for. And that's why I think it becomes later and later and later, and people have given up on it more and more and more, because frankly, as a church, we just haven't done a good job modeling this and our brokenness in our relationships here inside the house of God are oftentimes just as broken, just as muddled as they are on the other side of the walls. And so what I thought I would do is we would take the time we have left to close and to turn to this passage in the book of Song of Songs, which I think can help us with this a little bit. This is chapter 2, verse 7 in the book Song of Songs. Now, this book is racy. I mean, it's like, you know, it's not PG-13 in the Bible, okay? This is a serious psalm, wisdom book, and it's a depiction of marital love and sexual intimacy and what the beauty of that is when that happens together in this way. And it's not chronological. It's hard to read sometimes, okay? But it has a lot of wisdom to it, I think. And this one piece of wisdom is one that I just want to kind of end on as we talk about, well, how far is too far? We've gotten the whole sex thing out of the way. That's meant for something else. That's meant to be in marriage. But still, you haven't really answered, you know, there's still that question that hangs there. And so this is the advice that the speaker here gives to the ladies, to her friends. This is basically a scene of her on her wedding night. She's enjoying her wedding night, but then she comes to this realization in verse 7, and she says this. She says, "Daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles and by the does of the field." You know it's serious. Gazelles and those of the field, "do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires." Do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. What she's basically saying is, listen, you know, don't start the engine until you can drive the car. Right? Don't try to determine the lines that you're willing to cross or not cross in the heat of the moment, because the only line you care about in the heat of the moment is the finish line. So before you get there, before you get into these situations, you need to know and have thought about, okay, what does this relationship entail? What does it look like? And there's a principle that I want to share with you when you think about, okay, so don't get the engine started if we're ready to fully drive the car, to engage it or whatnot and drive. Don't do that. But then what is kind of another good way of thinking about in terms of relationships and purity as we're trying to form ourselves, you know, in this way? What is a good litmus test? And so last passage we're going to look at is from the book of 1 Thessalonians, over 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. It's near the end of the New Testament, a small little book, so we're going to turn to it real quick together. But I heard this passage preached when I was in college. We used to go to this conference every year around Christmas time. And during this conference, it was a you know, college ministry conference, they'd always have the dating talk. the dating talk. And this would be the one where everybody would go to and then they'd break up afterwards. That's basically how the progression of how that worked. And most of the time, like 9 out of 10 times, boy, that was a good call. You know, that was, and you know, if you had a girl you didn't really know how to break up with, just, hey, take her to the dating talk. You're good. It's kind of easy to go that way. But then you're using the God cards, so don't do that. But we would do this talk, and this idea got put forth. And I just think this is just a really wise, really wise idea. And so we're going to read it right here, 1 Thessalonians 4, verses 3 through 6. Here we go. It is God's will that you should be sanctified, that you should avoid sexual immorality, that each of you should learn to control your own body in a way that is holy and honorable, not in passionate lust like the pagans who do not know God. And here's kind of the key verse, verse 6. And that in this matter, no one should wrong or take advantage of a brother or sister. The Lord will punish all those who commit such sins as we told you and warned you before. So, this idea of take advantage of, to wrong or take advantage of, the actual Greek word here is a word that means defraud. It's the best way we can, I think, get to, and some translations actually have the word defraud one another. And so when you defraud someone financially, what do? Well, you write checks that your bank account can't cash. Right? That's what you defraud someone else. And in the same way, this is an idea of sexual fraud. It's when we promise with our body what we're not able to back up with our actual life, with our commitments. And so the idea there is that your level of physical intimacy in your romantic and dating relationships, it should correlate with the amount of actual commitment that you have with that other person. And this is just another reason why the ultimate commitment of marriage, which is done publicly, you know, I mean, it's not just, you know, the ability to mouth a four-letter word in the heat of the moment does not constitute commitment, right? And so this is what Tim Keller says. He says, in short, sex outside of marriage is wrong because every sex act is supposed to reflect an absolute and complete covenant unity. There must be no physical union unless there's also every other kind, a legal, economic, personal, emotional, and spiritual union. There must not be one unity without the rest. And the idea there is that he says you don't want to defraud a brother or sister in this matter. And it kind of goes two ways. There's one way you can defraud the brother or sister, and that's this. You can act like that you're more into them or more committed to them than you really are so that you can get something from them physically. That's one way. Or you can give them something physically to try to get something from them in terms of commitment and fidelity. But either way, there's a defrauding that's happening there. The other way is this, is that, I mean, most oftentimes your relationship, the chances are that person is not going to be the one you end up marrying. You're probably not going to, the first person you ever date, you just marry. That happens very seldom, right? So this idea is to treat this other person as a brother or sister in Christ in that way, but also to remember that this may be someone else's wife. This may be, probably is, someone else's husband that you're with. So how are you caring for them? What would happen if you met this couple on the street 5 years later after being in this relationship with you and you met their future spouse and them together? Would you be able to look them in the eye, shake their hand? How did you care for that other person in this time? Did you defraud them? Did you defraud yourself? Because ultimately, you know, sexual sin in the Bible, every other sin, I mean, this idea that every sin is equal or the same is actually not biblical. We don't have time to get all into that right now. But in terms of sexual sin, it says flee it because this type of sin is one that you sin against yourself, your very self with. So in a way, when you give yourself away continually to other people, you're not just defrauding them, but you're defrauding your own person, your own heart. And it's so easy to do. And as soon as we let this particular aspect of relationship sneak in, it's like the camel's nose under the tent. The whole camel is in there. Because after all, if you're really trying to get to know someone and listen to them and find out who this person is and connect with them on a deep level, is it easier to sit and to talk and to work through disagreements and to hash out tough questions and to make plans for the future and to build a life on a common calling? Or is it easier just to go make out? Oh, making out all the time. But it's not going to be something as a practice that's going to sustain you and develop you as a person and make you the kind of person that doesn't just fulfill their desires but is able to make commitments to those outside of themselves. That's what God has called us to do and to be as an example to the world, or people who can make our commitments, who can deny ourselves, who can love others really, really well. And this comes to my last point. That's enough on the outside of the marriage thing. But one of the things and one of the failures that we've got to recognize in our own house is this failure to not fully live into our marriage relationships in such a way that we live as those who are committed and self-sacrificial and even romantically keep the romance alive in a marriage relationship. These ideas of dating that I went over earlier, in terms of actually asking someone out face-to-face and having forethought and planning something, an activity to go do and do something fun together, and then spending that time, you know, in those ways, that doesn't have to end when you're married. You can still go to that person and ask them out. I mean, I know you're kind of my forever date. It's kind of a given, but I'm not going to take that givenness lightly. I'm not going to just, you know, oh, no, we're going out this week. No, go to your spouse. Initiate. Ask them, hey, do you want to do this? And have some forethought with it, guys, right? Or ladies, have some forethought. Plan something. Initiate, respond. This dance of pursuit and response doesn't end under the hoopah. It's just another beginning. Because this person that you're married to now is not going to be the same person 10 years from now. I mean, hopefully it's the same person. I'm just saying they're going to grow as a person, okay? They're going to grow as a person. And you've got to grow with them. You've got to pursue them as they grow. And as you grow, so you keep pursuing. You keep responding to one another. You have forethought and creativity in your relationships. Plan at least one dating experience at least once a month, if not weekly. Carve out that time to be together and serve and sacrifice for each other in ways that you know the other one responds to. Be intentional with the garden that God has given you to tend in your own place. If we do that well, and we show that there is great joy and purity and commitment and fidelity, there's great joy and love and intimacy between people who are fully committed and fully given to one another. If we can show the world a better place, because this world in relationships is literally dying for that. We're called to be a light, a city on a hill. It's my prayer that we take this teaching and we go out and we shine. Let's pray. God, please be with us, Lord. We just confess to you our own brokenness in this area. God, if there's anyone here that is hearing this word and they're feeling condemnation or guilt, and in one sense, guilt's not a bad thing. It's like pain in our body. It's what we do with the guilt. It's what we do with the pain. So God, I just pray that if we are feeling that, God, that we would take that to you. And God, we would know and understand that you are a God who delights, who moves, always moving towards us first with grace to heal, to forgive, to cleanse. That if someone is here and they've heard this and they thought, I just didn't know that was kind of the biblical standard. I didn't know that's what God intended sex to be. I didn't see that the wisdom before, and I made mistakes. Holy Spirit, I just pray that you would engulf them in your love, in your mercy. Let them know, God, that they are still your child, that you love them, that you can cleanse them, that Jesus, you make all things new. If there's a marriage relationship here that is just kind of stalled, God, you can make that new too. Lord, you are our hope, Jesus. As we gather here at the end, there'll be prayer partners up. And if I just encourage you, take this time to come, to pray, lay your burdens down, confess your sins at the altar. If you're at your wit's end, your last rope in your relationship, it's not too late. Nothing, no time is too late for God, and nothing is beyond the reach of his grace to you. So I invite you to come as we worship together and give an offering.